From time to time, we have been going through different themes in the book of Proverbs. We had several meetings in a row where we were just doing Proverbs, different themes and an introduction, but then we've broken it up and interrupted with other things once in a while. But what you have before you are notes on one of the major themes in Proverbs has to do with wealth. Of course, that's one of the major themes of the Bible, which is interesting because a lot of times people don't want the preacher to talk about money. But that's because preachers often talk the wrong way about money. They're always asking for money. But actually, you can't teach the whole counsel of God without talking about money, because following Christ intrudes into every aspect of your life. And, of course, it's part of the belief of Christians that when you become a Christian, you're a follower of Jesus. He owns you. He owns everything. And therefore, you don't have any money. You have his money under your management. And so, obviously, we spend money almost every day. I mean, we're using electric lights that we'll pay for later on. But we're spending money today. You know, if the air conditioner's on, we're spending money. It may not go out of our hands today, but we're using it. Life costs money. Food costs money. Money has to be made somewhere, and it has to be then administered. And that there are people in the world who don't have enough money. And some of that's not their fault, because sometimes there's governments that have policies that keep people from having enough. But in a free country, and we live in one that's still relatively free, if you don't have money, well, someone's going to have to cover it for you. You know, if you don't generate money, someone's going to have to generate extra so that they can carry your weight, which is not a very loving thing for a Christian to do. We're supposed to love our neighbors who love ourselves, and we should be more interested in being able to give and help people who can't make money than to put ourselves in the ranks of those who have to burden the rest of the body of Christ on it. You know, Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 5 was talking about widows in the church, and he said if widows don't have any, you know, children or nephews or anything like that that can support them, well, then the church should support them. But if they have offspring, then he said that let them support the widows so that they don't burden the church. That is, the church is concerned about the needy, concerned about the members in it who don't have enough, and the church bears the burden of that, or supposed to. Many churches don't, but the church did in the Bible times and should. And so, you know, everyone in the church is consuming. Not everyone is producing. You know, if you consume but don't produce, then somebody else is going to produce more. And that might be no fault of yours. You might be an invalid. You might be, you know, just past the age that there's employment opportunities for you. There may be circumstances beyond your control that prevent you from being able to produce income anymore. In which case, of course, unless you've saved up for that time in your life, you're going to be, in some measure, a burden on other people. But you shouldn't feel bad about that if it's not your fault. That's providence. God, you know, God wants the church to be generous. And if there's no one in need, there's no one to be generous to. You know, I mean, God has arranged things so that those who gather little should have no lack, and those who gather much should have no extra, Paul said in 2 Corinthians. He's quoting actually Exodus 16 there. But, you know, money is a part of everyday life. When we wash the clothes, we use detergent and water, which we pay for. When we turn the lights on, we use the money. When we eat any food, someone spent money on that food. So money is just a matter that's just infused into every aspect of life. And therefore, Christianity, which is also infused into every aspect of our life, doesn't just overlap, but dominates the whole realm of finances to someone who's taking Jesus seriously. And although the Proverbs are not written about Christianity, because they were written before there was such a thing as Christianity, they nonetheless teach principles that are built into creation, and into human society, which the Christian who does not observe them, again, is going to fail to carry his or her own end of the weight, and is going to be a burden on others, which we don't want to do. So we also know that the world loves money a great deal. A lot of Christians do too. Hopefully Christians grow up to the point where they don't love money. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and so you don't want to have that love of money. Though, and it's tempting when you are needy. It's tempting to be obsessed with money, not because you're greedy, but because you're needy. And yet, the desirable thing is that nobody in the body of Christ needs to be obsessed with money. That people who have plenty of it should be content with what they have. Those who don't have enough should not be worried about whether things will be taken care of, because God's going to take care of them largely through, hopefully, the gifts of the ones who have extra. So that money should not be an obsession, but it becomes a tool. It becomes a tool for serving God. I remember, I won't mention his name because I don't want to disrespect him, but there was a famous preacher who used to say, how about when you pray for missions, you don't just write a check this time. How about you go yourself? And whenever I heard him say that, I always thought, I wonder how much missionaries appreciate that. Don't write any checks to missionaries, just go yourself. Well, if every Christian left home, left their job, went on the mission field, the missionaries would starve, The truth is that paying missionaries to do work on the field is as important as those who go on the field. I mean, there's every aspect of economy is involved in the body of Christ. There's people who need to be supported to do certain kinds of work. There's people who need to do another kind of work to support them. So we need to realize that money is, if you don't have Christian perspective on money or biblical perspective on money, you simply are going to be out of line. You're going to be, as Paul put it, disorderly. When he was talking in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, he said that he used the word disorderly two or three times, talking about people who won't work, people who won't work and should not eat. But he uses the word disorderly for people. And actually that word in the Greek is a military word. It speaks of somebody who's out of step, out of rank. And, there are steps that every responsible person should be taking. And if a person is not taking theirs, then of course they're out of step. It's a disorderly situation. It's just like any other thing about other gifts of the body of Christ. The Bible does say in Romans 12, there's a gift of giving. But there's a whole bunch of other gifts too. And any one of the gifts, if the people who have those gifts don't do them, the body's going to be limping. There's going to be something that's not being done, some member of the body that's not functioning. And giving is actually most Christians, whether it's the main thing they do or not, have the opportunity to give. I myself have most of my adult life, I've lived off the generosity of others, but the Lord has provided for me even that way, enough that I can give plenty to others who have less than I do. So even though in many respects I've been on the receiving end of the generosity of other people, I'm able also, and I feel responsible to be, on the providing end as well, because there's very few people who can't give to someone who has greater needs than themselves. So let's just see what the Proverbs say about wealth in general. First category here in the notes is the attitudes that are associated with wealth. I don't bring up all of them because not all of them are in Proverbs. Obviously, one thing that is an attitude toward wealth that isn't in Proverbs but is necessary to realize is that anxiety about wealth is a very common attitude. People are afraid they won't have enough. Now, Jesus made it very clear, we're not supposed to take anxious thought for tomorrow, what we're going to eat or what we're going to drink. God takes care of the birds, he takes care of the flowers, he takes care of things much less valuable to him than we are. And since he does that, we can be quite sure that he'll take care of us too. We don't have to have anxiety about wealth. But that would be especially if we are functioning within the principles of wealth that the Bible teaches. If we are obedient in this area, then of course our worries can be allayed. One of the attitudes toward wealth that's very obvious in society and that Proverbs does talk about is that people get a sense of security and social standing from being wealthy. And I think a lot of people who want to be wealthy, I often wonder why people who are already rich want more money. I mean, why do any of these guys who are millionaires or billionaires, why do they care if they get more money? They can't legitimately spend what they have in a lifetime. They could give it all away, but if they're planning to do that, that's voluntary on their part. They don't have to worry about having enough money for that. They can give away what they want to give away. But it's clear that one reason that people want a lot of money is they can buy pleasures that others can't buy. But another, and this is much perhaps less, this is more of an innocent thing that people who want to get money are concerned about, is security. You know, I'm getting old. My earning power is limited. I don't know how many years I have to live. I don't know what the needs will be. Will I have loved ones? Who's going to need my support? Will I need support? Will I have a health crisis? And money is looked to quite naturally as a means of security. People who are poor don't feel very secure sometimes if they're not trusting God for their finances. They don't feel very secure about their future. Someone who's very rich probably does feel more secure, although very seldom satisfied with what they have. That they know. I mean, I can remember, I've lived by faith all my adult life, and I lived on very little and had very little come in most of the years of my life. But when I had a wife who was killed in an accident, and there was an insurance settlement that came to me. It wasn't huge by today's standards, but it was huge by my standards. You know, the amount that I was given in insurance settlement for her death was like what I was accustomed to having income for 2 years. It was like 2 years of income for me. And I didn't like having it because I like living by faith. And so I decided I'm going to get rid of all this money within 1 year. I didn't want to just write a check for all of it without doing some research, but I wanted to vet charities and things like that. And I wanted to make sure that by that time next year, after I got it, I'd have no more of that money left. And the reason was, it was uncomfortable for me having extra money because there was nothing to trust God for. Mm-hmm. Now, some people say, well, I feel just fine not having to trust God for anything. But all my life, that had been my choice. I want to live by faith. And I know that before that settlement was given to me, I didn't have any security except in God. I certainly didn't have financial security because I had no predictable income. But I remember thinking, you know, if my car would break down now, I could just buy another car. You know, I always drove old cars, and I don't know how to fix them and stuff, and they sometimes would break down. I remember having an old Volkswagen once when I was younger and single, and it stopped working. So I parked it in my driveway and walked and hitched rides with my friends and stuff like that for about 6 months. Then a friend of mine came over to visit and said, oh, I didn't know you had a car. I said, yeah, it won't start. And he looked under the hood, and there was an obvious wire that had come loose. He put it on there, and it started right up. I was walking for 6 months and hitchhiking for 6 months, and I could have just put the wire on there. But I'm just that stupid about cars. My cars are that unreliable. But I remember when I had that money, I thought, I don't have to worry. I don't have to trust God. I want to, but I don't have to. It's hard to trust God when there's nothing there to trust Him for. I knew that if my car broke down, I could leave it by the side of the road and buy another one. I didn't have to trust God for my phone bill to be paid each month or my rent. I was in a position to pay it way ahead if I needed to. And it really put me in a situation that was awkward for me. Because I realized that when you do have a lot of extra money, it's hard to trust God. Not because you don't want to, but there's just nothing there to trust Him for. I mean, maybe a real disaster. You might trust Him that, you know, if a nuclear bomb hit your town, that maybe you'd have shelter, you know, somewhere. Or, you know, I don't know. If there's a famine, you know, I guess you have to trust God about those kind of things. But in a normal economy, if you've got abundance, trusting God is just not something you can even do at the same degree. You can still trust God for other things, but security and social standing, this was never an issue for me because I never had enough to have any social standing, but money does provide those things, and Proverbs says so. In Proverbs 14:20, it says, the poor man is hated even by his own neighbors, but the rich has many friends. And Proverbs 19:4 says, wealth makes many friends, but the poor is separated from his friend. In other words, you're popular if you have money. One of the problems with having a lot of money is you don't know why you're popular. You have a good idea. You win the lottery, you have so many more relatives all of a sudden than you ever knew you had. You know, so many friends. But you don't know why. I mean, you have a pretty good idea, and it's a rather cynical answer. But the truth is, real friends are, well, real friends will be with you even when you're poor. But I think very few people have any real friends anyway. The poor people don't have very many, and the rich people have friends who can get stuff from them, and you never know if they're real friends or not. Billy Graham said he only had about 4 close friends in his life. Now, he was on a speaking basis with many presidents and many powerful people around the world. Everyone was friendly with him, but as far as real friends that he trusted, he only said he could count about 4. And I think that's about normal. Most people I've heard, who are famous people say they have about maybe 3 or 4 good friends. Someone said you can only have about 3 or 4 good friends. And I'm not sure what the limit would be because I've never reached that limit, but it might be above what I would think. But when you have a lot of money, you seem to have a lot of friends. And that's what Proverbs is saying. It gives you social standing. It also makes you feel secure because you can take care of yourself. In Proverbs 10:15, it says, the rich man's wealth is his strong city. The destruction of the poor is their poverty. Now, the rich man's riches are his strong city. That just means his security. It's like he's in a tower. He's in a walled city because his money builds a wall between him, a hedge between him and disaster. And it sounds like it's saying this is really true, because in a sense it is. It really is the case that if you have a lot of money, you can hedge yourself against a lot of disasters that a poor person can't be free from. And the destruction of the poor is their poverty. Sometimes bad things happen to poor people and take them out that could have been avoided if they had more money. So, I mean, money is a good thing to have. It is a security. But the problem is it's not as much a security as the rich man often thinks it is. And the next Proverbs 18:11, says the rich man's wealth is his strong city and like a high wall in his own esteem. That is, he views it that way. He trusts in it like a city depends on its walls to keep it secure. In his own esteem, his money is that. It provides him a security, but it might be a sense of false security because, of course, money does go away. And that's what the next point is money is unpredictable. It's amazing how many people, have had jobs and, good paying jobs, secure jobs. They may put down payment on a big house, get some new cars and stuff like that. And then unbeknownst to them, the company goes under, downsizes or something like that. And then they're stuck holding a bag with a whole bunch of debt. Wealth is not that predictable. The economy, I mean, at certain times, it seems to be. But in the long run, you just never really know what's going to happen next. Proverbs 13:7 says, there's one who makes himself rich, yet he has nothing, and one who makes himself poor and has great riches. Now, this may be talking about two different kinds of riches. He may be saying there's a man who makes himself financially rich, but he's really spiritually poor. That's a possibility. And a man who makes himself financially poor, but he really has great riches. I mean, that's what Jesus said to the church of Smyrna. He says, I know your poverty, but you're rich. And what he said to the church of Philadelphia is, you say I'm rich and have need of nothing, but you don't realize you're poor and naked and blind and destitute. This Proverbs 13:7 might be saying, a person makes himself rich financially, but he's really not rich in the way that matters. On the other hand, most of these statements about Proverbs are about physical riches. And a man may labor to be rich and still end up in poverty. A man may labor to be poor and end up with a lot of money. And that's something I wouldn't have been able to relate to a few years ago. I can now. I'm in a comfortable situation. God provides for me. I'm not in poverty anymore. And now I'm in a position I can help other people. And I made no effort to make money ever. I don't now any more than I did when I was young, but it's the Lord provides. A man may make himself poor and yet have great riches. But Proverbs 23, 4 and 5 says, do not overwork to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Which some of you have been probably pretty wealthy at an earlier time in your life and may have experienced reversals in that area. Solomon, who wrote this, certainly knew a lot of wealth. But he was also in touch with reality. He'd seen enough reality to know that even when you have a lot of money, sometimes it just seems to fly away. Where'd it go? The same author in Ecclesiastes 5:11 said, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? You could just get to wave goodbye to them. When your riches increase, think, oh, wow, I'm really well off. Well, then all the neighbors and the friends and the relatives come up because they know you're rich and the consumers come. But even if it's not that case, even if your friends aren't all showing up to get money and stuff from you, it seems like no matter how much money you have, consumption of it, of the whole amount, is no difficulty. That is to say, no trouble spending it all. You know, it's easy for those who eat it up to equal, you know, any amount that comes in. It's sort of like space, how much storage space you have. Do you have enough? Never. If you have extra space, it'll get filled up. It's just the law of nature. And if you have lots of money, unless you make arrangements for this not to happen, that is, unless you guard your finances and manage them carefully, there will be plenty of takers, merchants, you know, friends. There just seems to be no limit to the places money can go. And it gets wings and flies away. In Proverbs 27:1, it says, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. Now, this is under our topic of wealth is unpredictable. But it's made, that very principle is made clearer in the book of James. In James 4, verses 13 through 15, James said, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, make profit. James says, whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow, which is what Solomon said. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. We don't know what we're going to do tomorrow. We're not sure we'll even be alive. We can't really boast in tomorrow. Proverbs 28:22 says, a man with an evil eye, which means a greedy man, hastens after riches. He does not consider that poverty will come upon him. So whereas Solomon says that wealth can be like a hedge against disaster. It can be a strong tower to the person who has it. And it can be disastrous for a person who doesn't have it. It can be destructive. The poverty of the poor can be his destruction. Yet even the rich can't count on things always being the same. Riches fly away. A man may have riches, even greedy for his riches, hoarding them, as it says in Proverbs 28:22, and not helping the poor. But he doesn't consider that poverty's coming around the bend for him. Now, the primary attitude that you read again and again in Proverbs about money and about wealth is that there's a whole lot of things that are more desirable than it. Now, people who don't know God often can't think of anything really more desirable than money. After all, you can do a lot of good things with money, even for other people. And for yourself and for your kids, and leave them a fortune and have a lot of fun. And, you know, you can do a lot of good things with money. And those who are materialistic often can't think of anything else that could be possibly of greater value. But Proverbs has many things it mentions are better than money. In Proverbs 15, verses 16 and 17, Solomon said, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than a great treasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is And he's not advocating veganism. We would say there's rich people who choose a dinner of herbs now. In those days, people would prefer to eat a heartier meal than that. And so a dinner of herbs is someone who's really poor. He's got to go out and gather herbs, probably in the wild, to put food on the table. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. So a little bit with the fear of the Lord is enough. Now, a little bit is not much money, but the fear of the Lord is worth a great deal, more than money. And love in the home is. Better to have a poor meal in a poor home where everyone's on good terms, everyone loves each other, than as in many rich families where they, even kings have these huge feasts they lay out, but there's war between their family members. I mean, David's family in the Bible is an example of that. Very wealthy king, but his sons were killing each other, hated each other. And there's plenty of families that you can't get the whole family around the table because some won't eat with the others. Some won't be in the same room with others. I was in a church once where two sisters went to the same church and sat on different sides of the aisle with their husbands and wouldn't speak to each other for years. They wouldn't look at each other. If you're in a family that loves each other, but the food's not great, you've got a better situation than somebody who's got a great meal in front of them and they have strife in their family and hatred. Proverbs 16:8 says, better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. Being righteous, knowing that your conscience is clear, but you only have a little money. You could have gotten more money by cheating. Could have gotten more money by being a robber, but you're living an honest life. And because of it, you don't have as much as you might if you would compromise more. But having a little bit with righteousness is better than being really wealthy without justice. And I think that means if you've gotten it unjustly, if you've, cheated or done something like that, you've forsaken justice to get the revenues. The revenues are not worth much compared to righteousness. Proverbs 17:1 says, better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. So that's essentially the same point we saw in chapter 15. Chapter 19, verse 22, what is desired in a man is kindness, and a poor man is better than a liar. Now, kindness is actually in the Hebrew the word chesed, C-H-E-S-E-D. It's a very common word in the Old Testament, very hard to translate. A lot of times in the King James Version, it's translated loving kindness, faithful love is another way it's translated. Chesed is used mainly in the Hebrew with reference to someone who keeps covenant obligations they have. They're faithful, they're reliable. I'm not sure why kindness is chosen as a translation as much as it is because the lexicons all are pretty clear on this. It's a very important word in the Old Testament. It refers to being faithful to your covenant, being an honest man of integrity. And it's contrasted with a liar here. What's desired in a man is this kind of integrity. A poor man is better than a liar. A liar is a man with no integrity. Better is the poor, it says in Proverbs 28:6, better is the poor who walks in his integrity than one who is perverse in his ways, though he be rich. You're starting to sound like a broken record here a little bit. Same ideas worded differently. Proverbs 28:11, the rich man is wise in his own eyes, but the poor man who has understanding searches him out. A wise man has the luxury of thinking he's smarter than other people. For one thing, he thinks if he wasn't, he wouldn't be rich. Where do you think he got all this? He played his cards right. He pulled the right strings. He made the right connections. He's smarter than most people. That's why he's richer than most people. But a poor man who has understanding can search him out. Now, I'm not sure what search him out, what Solomon's thinking of in that phrase in this particular case, but basically, obviously means to show his faults. The poor man who has understanding can defeat him in a debate, for example. The man's smart in his own eyes, but being rich isn't what makes you smart. A poor man can be wise enough to uncover that person's foolishness. Now, when it comes to obtaining money, we want to talk about obtaining money, and we want to talk about dispensing of money, and then we'll be done here. Of course, obtaining money is a high priority for most people. Pretty unusual to find people who don't make that a priority at some level. But there's a fundamental understanding of wealth that is expressed in several verses in Proverbs. One of them is in chapter 11, verse 4. Proverbs 11, 4. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. Now, the day of wrath, I assume, is the day of God's anger. When God is angry, having a lot of money won't help you. Hank Williams had a song that said, "Your money won't save your poor wretched soul." That was the refrain at the end of every verse. Your money won't save your poor wretched soul. Well, it won't. Money won't help you. Wealth won't help you in the day of judgment, in the day of wrath. But righteousness delivers. You know, it's going to be worth more to be righteous than to be rich. And the next verse kind of is similar. Proverbs 11, 28. He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like foliage. So we have the rich man versus the righteous man. He's not saying that the righteous man can't be a rich man or that the rich man can't be a righteous man. He's just saying that a man who has riches but isn't righteous, well, he'll fall. A man who's righteous, whether he has riches or not, will flourish, not necessarily financially. That's 11:28. In Proverbs 22:2, it says, "The rich and the poor have this in common: the Lord is the maker of them all." Now that almost sounds so basic. It's like, why do you need to have that said? Of course, God made everything. But I think the point he's making is that in society, attitudes toward the rich and the poor are not always the same. But God's attitudes toward rich and poor people, he's the maker of all of them. What they have, he gave them. It says in James, you know, every good gift, every perfect gift comes down from above and is from the Father of lights. So, you know, if someone's rich, well, God's made it possible for them to be rich. I was going to say God made them rich, but some people make themselves rich dishonestly. And I wouldn't say God made them rich, but he gave them the wits. He gave them the opportunities. He gave them the position that they were in, that they were able to get rich. They could have gotten rich honestly, perhaps, but not everyone has. The point is, though, that if you are an honest person and poor, or you're an honest person and rich, that's God's doing. God is the one who kind of puts people in those positions. It's like what God said to Moses in, I think it's chapter 3 of Exodus, when he was at the burning bush, and Moses said, "I can't speak to Pharaoh. I'm slow of speech." God said, who made the dumb? Who made the blind? Who made the seeing? Who made the lame? Did not I, the Lord? I mean, whatever state a person is in that's beyond their own control, that's God's providence. That's how God worked it out for you. You can rejoice in that. Now, two very frequent themes in Proverbs have to do with work, hard work being the source of money. And secondly, of the not only the lack of virtue, but the vice of being lazy. As far as Proverbs about making money by work, we have to remember that Adam and Eve were given work to do before they fell. But it wasn't hard work. It was enjoyable work, tending a garden that was already pre-cultivated. God cultivated the garden before he put them in it. They didn't have to tame the wild like, you know, pioneers coming across America and building a log cabin and trying to tame the wilds. They were put into a cultivated garden. They were just to keep it up, which I'm sure in the nature of the way they were made, that was probably something that was quite enjoyable and fulfilling to do. But when they sinned, God told them they're going to go out where there's thorns and thistles. They're not going to be in the garden anymore. They're going to be out in the wild. They're going to have to, you know, plow it and work it. So from that time till now, anyone who eats is eating something that somebody worked to produce. Now, of course, we have machinery and stuff, labor-saving devices now. For centuries and centuries and centuries, making food out of the ground was simply arduous. Now we have, you know, climate-controlled cabs and these big harvesters and things like that, and plows and tractors. But still, someone's got to put in the work, It may be a little easier to do it now than it used to be, but it still has to be done. And if somebody's not doing that, then somebody's not going to eat. And so that's what the Bible's teaching is. Wealth is produced by labor. Now, I think I mentioned this before, the socialist idea, or especially the communist form of socialism, is that wealth is just there, and it's to be distributed. And if somebody has more than someone else, it's because they got more than their share. And the person who doesn't have as much has been ripped off of their share. It's like it's the pie model of wealth. It's like a pie. Everyone should get an equal slice. If someone gets a bigger slice than the average, someone else has to get a smaller slice because there's a finite amount of wealth. And so the socialist slash communist idea is that you need to distribute it equally or someone's being cheated. The biblical idea is some people will be richer than others, but everyone can be as rich as they want to be. Well, of course, we're talking about people living in situations where food can be grown, not in the middle of the Sahara Desert, probably, you know, and in countries where the government just doesn't confiscate everything that comes from it. But in a situation where there's a, you know, arable land and climate, if there's rich people and poor people in that same area, it's not necessary that someone has to take the rich man's money to even things up. The poor man can work too. And if he works as hard and as smart as the rich man, in most cases, he might be as rich as the rich man. If not as rich, certainly well off enough. It's not that the rich man is rich by cheating the poor man. And, you know, whenever I hear young people who don't know anything, usually from universities, which is why they don't know anything, they act like, you know, capitalism's a really bad thing because there's these really rich guys who run these companies and they get really big salaries and their workers are getting much less than they are. Well, honestly, I've never worked for more than minimum wage. Whenever I had a job, I never got more than minimum wage. I never envied that my manager was getting more than I was and the people who owned the business was making more than I was. I could try to own a business if I wanted to. I just didn't want to. I could strive to be in management if I wanted to. I just didn't want to. The choices you make determine a lot of that stuff. If somebody wants to be rich, they may strive to be rich and they'll work harder and smarter and they'll get richer. That's just usually the way it is. Most of the people who work for him don't want to start their own company and have all the headaches of running a company. They'd rather let him have the headaches and they just show up and punch a clock and they get their money. These are different life choices people are making. The guys who own these big companies they're not richer because they're cheating. Now, some of them may be cheating. I'm not saying there is no cheating. I'm not saying there's no one ripping anyone else off. I'm just saying that the fact that the guys at the top have more money does not mean that they're cheating. They may not be cheating at all. And like I said, whenever I worked I was always at the bottom rung in any job I held and didn't bother me at all. If I wanted to make more money, I could pursue that. But I only wanted to work enough to put food on the table and a roof over my head so I can go out and minister. I want to study the Bible all day. I didn't want to work all day. Those are choices people make. And, you know, if you can't make any money in a profession you're in, you can look for another profession. I mean, there's just, if you work hard, you should have enough unless there's injustice in the society that is beyond your control. And that's usually governmental. That's not usually having to do with the people who employ you. So, anyway, this is the biblical concept of wealth. Wealth is created by work. It's not like there's a finite amount of wealth and we just have to divide it up fairly. No, you create wealth. More food. Food is wealth. Food is wealth. Everything else is fluff. Food is what you need to survive and what everyone needs. If you grow a lot of food, you'll have enough to eat and you can change some of it for things you don't need or things you can't produce. Food is wealth and food is produced by work. And, that's what the Bible teaches. So anyone can have enough if they work enough. Now, there are things like when you get old or you're handicapped or disabled or whatever and you can't work. Well, that's when charities and the church and your extended family and stuff can come to your aid. Not the government, hopefully, but there's a lot of people closer to you who care more about you than the government does, who can take care of those things and should. So here's what Proverbs says. Proverbs 13:11. Wealth gained by dishonesty will be diminished, but he who gathers by labor will increase. So you try to get money dishonestly, you may get it, but it'll be diminished. You might even go to jail and lose it all. But wealth, he who gathers by labor will increase. You work, you'll get more. Proverbs 14:4, where no oxen are, the trough is clean. But much increase comes by the strength of the ox. And we talked about this one under another heading in a previous month, but what this means is if you have an ox, you're going to have to muck out the barn. That's the kind of work you may not like doing. So you might just say, I'm not going to need an ox. An ox just makes too much work. Well, but an ox is a labor-saving device. And you can do a whole lot more plowing, a lot more acres if you have an ox, than if you're pushing that plow with just your human strength. You may have to put in a little effort. You might have to invest a little. You might have, sometimes, especially at the beginning, you may have to live, greatly pinched financially and working harder than other times, but you have to make choices, investments and so forth, and you have to decide, well, I'd have to work a lot more in the barn if I had an ox, but I wouldn't have to work as long in the field, and I'd produce a lot more. I mean, you just have to weigh things. Smart people who are trying to balance their budget and their business and so forth, their farm, have to make decisions like that. Chapter 14, verse 23 says, in all labor there is profit, but idle chatter leads only to poverty. So, obviously, if you just stand around talking, unless, of course, you've got a job doing podcasts, and then, that may be your work, is idle chatter. But chapter 15, verse 27, he who is greedy for gain troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live. That's another dishonest way to get money, if you're in power, to take bribes. You need to hate those bribes, and don't be eager to get money. You'll trouble your own house. Stories like that are abundant. You see them sometimes in TV and some of the true stories about crime and stuff like that. Someone just wants to get money really bad. They want to kill somebody and get the insurance policy or something like that, and it troubles their whole house. Of course, they end up in jail, but, ruins their whole family. Everything's destroyed by their dishonesty because they were greedy for money. That's what he says. Chapter 21, verse 5, the plans of the diligent will surely lead surely to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty, surely to poverty. Once again, hasty to get rich. Solomon suggests it's better if you want to be rich, build it up at a reasonable rate. Work and save and don't waste, and your wealth will accumulate. But if you're hasty to get rich, you're going to be jumping into these pyramid schemes and criminal schemes and different things, all kinds of shady things where it promises a fast buck. Well, that surely leads to poverty. But the plans of the diligent is the hard worker, the person who works hard, the plans that he makes and diligently works toward leads to plenty. So the diligent has a plan and he works his plan. Most young people need to be told this these days. And that is, you don't just play video games in your parents' basement and expect a great job to come to you or great money to come to you. No, you need to make a plan and you need to work the plan. And you have to be patient. Because being hasty for wealth you'll become discouraged if you don't get wealthy fast enough. But you just have to be patient and hardworking, and that's what Proverbs teaches. And it's true. And Proverbs 21:17 says, he who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich. So this has to do, of course, with another way you can avoid getting poor. Don't have expensive tastes, Paul said, having food and clothing, we will with these things be content. I don't know if he ever got wealthy, but he didn't end up spending much either. Having inexpensive tastes is one way to, well, let's put this, having expensive tastes, he says, is a way to go broke. And people, when they start to make money, especially if they start making more money than they're used to, they start going out and a lot of times they'll buy things on credit that they can't buy yet. And they'll just go into debt and it'll destroy them. Proverbs 28:8, one who increases his possessions by usury and extortion gathers it for him who will pity the poor. Usury, of course, in modern English means extreme interest rates, excessive interest rates. In biblical times, usury just meant interest. And as our economy, our society is built on interest, banking. Banks exist because they charge interest. And banks finance every business. And they finance every project and every farm, and the government. I mean, everything, government bonds, you know. The government's, you know, makes money off government bonds, and they do so by paying interest. We have a society that just, it's based on interest. But biblically, all charging of interest was forbidden, unless you were lending to a foreigner. A Jew was not allowed to charge interest of a fellow Jew. If a man was poor, you shouldn't even want any interest from him. You should just lend to him, and if you lose it, you lose it. If he pays it back without interest, well, you did it out of generosity. So usury in the Bible means interest. Like I said, today, because our whole society is based on interest, we have another word, usury, to mean excessive interest. But in the Bible, it says, he who increases his possessions by charging interest on loans and extortion gathers it for him who will pity the poor. It means he'll lose it eventually, and a better person it'll come into their hands by the providence of God. He's not saying it naturally tends toward that. It's not like naturally, you know, the banker's wealth is going to end up with a philanthropist ends up with that guy's money. But that's not nature. But he's speaking of that as something of divine providence. God will reshift that finances. 28:19-20, Proverbs 28:19-20 says, he who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows frivolity will have poverty enough. A faithful man will abound with many blessings, but he who hastens to be rich will not go unpunished. Again, hastening to be rich almost always involves compromise. You can almost never get rich quickly, honestly. There might be times where you might inherit your parents' fortune or something like that. But to hasten to be rich, if it is your goal to get rich and soon, quickly, well, you're probably going to do some things that you're going to end up being punished for. He who hastens to be rich shall not go unpunished. Now, I told you there's a lot of verses about sluggards. I want to tell you about sluggards, and this may be the last section we'll get through today. There's more sections in my notes, but we will not have time for them. Some of the more humorous statements in Proverbs are talking about sluggards. Solomon had no respect for a sluggard. To him, a sluggard was like one of the great vices. One of the greatest vices was that of a sluggard. Now, you know, if you're a sluggard, that is, if you don't produce much, you could produce more if you're more diligent, but you're kind of lazy, so you don't produce much. If you're willing to live on what you produce, I mean, I guess it's not a vice. It's still, but it might be, because God gives you the power to make more. And making more is good, because if you make more, you can do more for the kingdom of God. You see, every minute you have is a minute you have to decide, how am I going to use this minute? Or am I going to invest it? Is your time passing, or is it being invested in something? And it may not be that God wants you to use all your time making money. There are things better than money. There's things better to do with your time than making money. But maybe not for some people. Maybe making money is the very best use of their time they can do, and they end up financing missionary work or something else of value, feeding the poor. Those are good things. Making money can be extremely virtuous if you're doing it with the mind that this is what God has given me the ability to do. I can make money, and I can help a lot of people who need help that can't make money. Okay? But So even if you're saying, well, I don't want to make much money, I'll just live, on little. Well, there's nothing wrong with living on little. But if you're living on little because you're lazy, not because you're content with little and you've got better things to do than go out and make money, that's a different thing. But if you're living on little just because you don't want to get out of bed and you don't want to do work, and I guess I'll live on little because no one's going to hand me any money and I don't want to make any, then that's a vice. And laziness, or the slothful man, as it's in the King James, is always seen as a really bad person. Not because they're doing other bad things, although they might be. A slothful man may very well get money by robbery or something like that, and he does it because he doesn't want to work for it. But even if you're not doing anything bad other than being lazy, you're being wasteful of opportunities that God has given you. And that's something we'll answer for. Remember the story of the talents, how the master gave one of his servants 5 talents, and one 2 talents, and one talent. And the guy with 2 talents, the guy with 5 went out and invested it, made more money for the kingdom, for his father, for his master, I should say. The guy who had 1 talent, he just hid it in the ground. He didn't want to lose it. He wanted to be able to give it back when his master showed up, but he didn't invest it. He didn't make any money for his master. He did not increase his master's estate. He just did nothing with it. And he was thrown out into outer darkness. Because although he could give back the talent that he had, he didn't steal it, but he had a responsibility for it that he didn't use. His master said, why don't you at least put it in the bank? Then I could have had a little bit of interest on it. I mean, your obligation was to take what I gave you and make me some money. And of course, in what this is talking about is God gives us various opportunities and assets to advance his interest, his kingdom, his movement. And we can use our advantages that way or not. A lazy person is not using the advantages he has to the extent that he could. So it says in Proverbs 10:4, he who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So that's kind of the same thing you were saying earlier, but the reverse is talking about the slack hand, the lazy man, he becomes poor. Chapter 12, verse 11, he who tills his land will be satisfied with bread, but he who follows frivolity is devoid of understanding. That sounds pretty much like one we read earlier. Chapter 13, verse 4, the soul of the lazy man desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. Chapter 18, verse 9, he who is slothful in his work is a brother to him who is a great destroyer. Now, when Proverbs say so-and-so is a brother to such-and-such, there's several Proverbs that say this kind of person is a brother to that kind of person. It just means they have a family resemblance. They're similar. They're not really brothers, but he's saying that person is like this person. He's like a brother to him. They both have the family resemblance. They're similar to each other. A man who's slothful in his work is like a person who's a great destroyer. Now, a man who's slothful in his work may be maintaining things without improving them, but if he's lazy, he's probably not even maintaining them quite. There's such a thing as the second law of thermodynamics. There's entropy. Things wear down. You have to work just to keep them from getting worse. We've noticed that with this house. I mean, this house, we've had so many things come up with it. Bees make their hives in the walls and things. It costs a lot of money and work just to maintain it. And Dana works like crazy on that backyard. I mean, it's a beautiful yard, but it's that way because of her hard work. If nobody was working on the house or on the yard, it would fall apart. You might as well destroy it. You're just destroying it slower. It's going to destroy itself without maintenance. And so the man who's lazy and doesn't keep things up, he's in the same family with the person who just comes out with a wrecking ball and wrecks the thing. The wrecking ball does it quicker, but it's the same work. Things get destroyed if they aren't maintained by somebody doing some work. So Proverbs 20 and verse 4 says, the lazy man will not plow because of winter. He will beg during the harvest and have nothing. I guess I don't know much about farming, but the winter is when you can't really grow seed, but that's where you plow up the ground so that when the spring comes, you can sow it and then by summer there's crops. But if you don't want to be out in the cold, don't want to work in the winter, don't want to go out in the rain or whatever, well, then you won't plow, and then you'll find out there's consequences for that when it comes time to harvest and there's nothing to harvest. Proverbs 20 and verse 13, do not love sleep. Now, there's nothing wrong with sleep, except in Proverbs, the man who loves sleep is the person who'd rather sleep than work, basically. He's a lazy man. Do not love sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes. In other words, wake up, get out of bed, and you'll be satisfied with bread. Now, the last verses we're going to look at are these last ones on the sluggard. There's three of them in a row in Proverbs 26, verses 14 through 16. He says, as a door turns on its hinges, so does a lazy man on his bed. He rolls over a little bit, but the hinges still keep him attached to that. The door, there's some motion there, but it never comes loose from the door jamb. The hinges, the person's attached to his bed. He may roll over, change position, but he's going to be in bed. He's like a door on his hinges. So he's attached to his bed. Verse 15 says, the lazy man buries his hand in the bowl. It wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. This came up earlier, too, in a previous lecture. The idea is, you know, he's so lazy that even when he reaches into the bowl to get the food from the middle of the table, like they did in the Middle Eastern things, and dip the sop in the hummus or whatever, I don't think I have enough energy to bring it back to my mouth. I'll just leave my hand here in the bowl. it's a parody. These are parodies, but Solomon, this shows how much he respects lazy people. They're like a door on its hinges in their bed. They're like, he's so lazy that they might reach out to grab the food, but they just can't get it back to eat it. Too much energy required for that. And then there's one more in verse 16. He says, the lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. Now, this probably means that a lazy man can make up all kinds of clever excuses to counteract every wise person's point they make to get him to go out and carry his own weight. He can come up with an excuse. One of the Proverbs says, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the streets. I'll be torn to pieces. That's another one of Solomon's jokes about this. This is awful. You know, now, there could be lions in the streets. There were lions in Israel, but not very often in the streets. It might be a chance in a million there'd be lions in the streets, but there is that chance. So you're saying there's a chance. only one chance in a million you'll get it. So you're saying there's a chance. I better stay in. There might be a lion out there. I was going to go to work today, but you know those lions, I'll be sorry if I go out there and there's lions. I'll just stay indoors and stay on my bed. That's the excuses a lazy man makes. And he can make up, he thinks he's smart, smarter than seven men who can give better answers than that. Though I wonder too, if part of this proverb, the lazy man is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly, might be applied in another situation, and that is to intellectual laziness. Because we encounter this a lot. I encounter a lot of intellectual laziness, even in churches, even among ministers. There are people who, they learn something, they've repeated it for 30 years, and then someone points out to them, that may not be right. They don't even want to think about it. I get tired just thinking about changing my mind about that. You know, I mean, if I'm wrong about that, then all these other things are connected. I'm probably wrong about that. I may have to go back to square one. I get tired just thinking about it. No, I'm in good company with people who see it my way. I'll stay here. Mm-hmm. You find seven men who can answer them sensibly, but they're still wiser in their own eyes because they're too lazy to think for themselves. I'll be glad to just go along with what my teachers told me, what my denomination teaches. You know, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to do any hard work. And I'm smart enough, at least in my own eyes I am, and in the eyes of the people who agree with me. So why do I need to listen to seven smart men giving answers and rebuttals? I'm smarter than them. At least I can pretend like I am, because it's too much work to allow myself to think otherwise. Because then I'll have the responsibility to do some vigorous thinking which is, frankly, another kind of laziness that we find too often amongst. There's certainly plenty of physical laziness, but there's a lot of intellectual laziness too. There's more, obviously, on your notes, but we don't have more time for it, so we're going to stop at that point. We might take the rest next time, or we might go another direction. Depends on what I'm feeling like. But you have the notes. Those of you who are here, you who are listening, don't. I think we probably have them at Matthew 7:13 posted there, if I'm not mistaken, under Proverbs.